Today's Access Utah episode was first broadcast in March of 2016.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. All her life, Emily felt different from other kids. Between therapist visits, sudden uncontrollable bursts of anger, and unexplained episodes of dizziness, things never felt right. For years, her only escape was through the stories she crafted. It wasn't until a near-fatal accident, when she was 12 years old, that Emily and her family discovered the truth, a grapefruit-sized brain tumor at the base of her skull. In her new memoir, All Better Now, Utah writer Emily Wing Smith chronicles her struggles with both mental and physical disabilities, the devastating accident that may have saved her life, and her way through it all, writing. Emily Wing Smith received her master's degree in writing for children and young adults from Vermont College. She's the author of previous books, Back When You Were Easier to Love and The Way He Lived, and she lives with her husband in Salt Lake City, where she says she writes, bakes chocolate chip cookies, and occasionally substitutes at her old high school, which she says hasn't gotten any less odd. We welcome in Emily Wing Smith. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, you're welcome, and thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us on the program. I want to start with how the memoir came about. I think this was a suggestion from your publisher, said you have a very interesting story. I believe you were somewhat resistant to the idea of writing a memoir.
I was. I mean, I guess resistant might not be the correct word. I was more thinking, it sounds sort of self-indulgent. I was a writer and obviously had written two young adult books, but I was still kind of under the impression that people had to be a little more well-known. It seems like famous people wrote memoirs, but I wasn't famous or even particularly well-known in my field. And so to be able to just be like, well, my story is interesting. I mean, yeah, my story is interesting to me, but I didn't know if it would be interesting to a wider audience. It was when my editor for my previous two books had heard my story and said, no, this is interesting to everyone. I think you should share. And that's when I felt okay about going ahead with it.
Mm-hmm. And what's the audience, do you think? You write it, you've written young adult novels, and I think this could be read and enjoyed by, I guess, young adult and up.
Yeah, definitely. It's published as a young adult novel, so by my same Dutton Books for Young Readers. So it is a young adult book and had the same editor and was released in conjunction with a re-release of my first book, The Way He Lived, which was originally published in 2008 and is now being released 8 years later in hardcover at the same time as my memoir. It's generally for a young adult audience, but a lot of the people who I've heard from who have really connected with the book are also adults. So yeah, I would say young adult and up.
So there's a lot in here I think people can relate to. I mean, there's some extraordinary things that, you know, I don't know if anybody's experienced, but not fitting in, right? And that's, I think, in our teen years, that's a big problem and continues for many of us into adulthood.
Yeah, definitely. I've loved hearing from people and hearing from people who've connected with the book. It's Brain Injury Awareness Month, so a lot of people have reached out to me who I don't know and said, I really connected with your book. I have a brain injury, too. I know just what you're going through. And we'll connect that way. And then there will be a lot of people who they say, I've gone through nothing of what you've gone through, but I feel like I know you, and I feel that you and I have a lot in common. And I think that's been the really gratifying part of it, is realizing that we kind of all feel different and weird, and it doesn't matter what our situation is, we can all relate to that.
Now, the extraordinary part of it that I'm guessing not many people, if any, experienced, you say you are sometimes referred to as the thank God she got hit by a car girl.
Yes. It was pretty interesting. I got headaches my entire life growing up. In fact, I sometimes joke that I didn't, like, I was about six before I even realized there were such a thing as headaches. I sort of just thought, because they were all I'd ever experienced and all I really knew was my own experience, I just figured that it was the default setting for the human brain was just to be in pain all the time. And so it didn't strike me that, like, this was at all unusual. And then when I figured it out, I was like, oh, well, that figures. That's why it figures because I'm the weird girl. So that's why I have this weirdness of always having my headaches. And, you know, as I got older, I was kind of a difficult child. I had behavioral problems, lots of anger issues, and a pretty bad anxiety. So I went to a lot of doctors and a lot of therapists. And mainly the doctor said, you know, she has a lot of anxiety, puts a lot of pressure on herself, and that's probably why these headaches are. And so the doctors and therapists both were like, yeah, this is sort of a psychological issue more than a medical one. And it was only when I was crossing the street when I was 12 after a shopping trip that I was hit by a car, sustained some pretty severe head trauma to the front of my head. And it was through scans that they realized that I had a pre-existing brain tumor that nobody had known about. And it was about the size of a grapefruit. And yeah, nobody had caught it yet. And it kind of put things into perspective of, oh, this would be why.
And so the doctors discovered it then and removed it, I believe.
Yes. Yeah, it was completely operable. So that was a miracle. It was so big, but it could be removed without removing a lot of the tissues that you need to live. It wasn't cancerous, and I didn't need chemo or any radiation, any follow-up treatments in terms of that. It was all surgically removed. So that was very good. But also, I mean, people said this couldn't have gotten any bigger. It was encroaching on her brainstem, and it was right now just affecting my motor skills, and I was getting more and more uncoordinated the older I got, and my headaches were getting worse and worse. But it was getting pretty soon to get big enough that it would have just simply blocked the flow of cerebral spinal fluid to my body, and I most likely just would have gone to sleep and never woke up. So,
mm-hmm. So that's where that phrase, thank God she got hit by a car. Normally, that wouldn't be a thank God thing, but for you, it was. I wonder if I could have you read a passage, page 114.
Oh, yeah, of course.
This is you've awakened, I guess, not quite sure what has happened. I guess they've told you got hit by a car when you're 12 years old. By the way, we're talking with Emily Wing Smith. She lives in Salt Lake City. Her memoir is called All Better Now. And perhaps you read that 114 and then the 115, which is a partial page.
Okay, excellent. Dad says, Emily, do you know what a brain tumor is? Yes, I do know what a brain tumor is. I'm relieved that as sick as I am, I still have the smart girl recall that's become my personal trademark. I may be a loser, but I'm a smart loser with a mind like a steel trap. I remember everything. I read a book about a girl with a brain tumor. This mass of craziness in her head keeps getting bigger and bigger, and it's her dying wish to go to Disney World, so her sister sneaks her out of the hospital to make her dream come true. When you have an out-of-control mass of craziness in your head, the end is inevitable. I wonder if a different girl, a girl lying on the other side of the blue circus tent curtain, has a brain tumor. A brain tumor is the kind of thing I always thought I'd have, a real out-of-control mass of craziness in my head to explain the out-of-control craziness I've always felt in my head. Something we would discover and say, ah, so this explains it. And I would lie in a hospital bed very much like this one, and I would not look like a boxer in a title fight. I would look like an elegant Victorian princess. They'd all line up to see me as I lay with my arms folded across my chest, holding a red rose mid-bloom. I'm sorry, they'd say. I didn't realize there was an out-of-control mass of craziness in your head. No one who is dying deserves to be treated the way I treated you. Lots of people would say that. The kids in the neighborhood. The kids from the neighborhood, the kids from school, my sister, my parents. They would all beg my forgiveness, which I would graciously bestow with my parting breath. And then I would be taken from this earth, never again to deal with the pain and suffering I had endured for so long. But I don't have a brain tumor. I have a car accident. So I tell my father, it's something people get in their head and then they die. And he pauses before he says it. Sometimes people die, but they don't think you will. It doesn't make sense. I don't have a brain tumor. I have a car accident. I'm not a Victorian princess. I'm a beat-up 12-year-old with braces. It doesn't make sense, but then it does, and then it hurts to keep my eyes open, so I close it. And one last thought is, I have a brain tumor, and I have a car accident.
And there are several passages there, kind of give you an insight into the young Emily, who says in this passage, I may be a loser, but I'm a smart loser.
Yeah.
Which is, spunky, problematic view of yourself as well.
Yeah, it's definitely the view I had of myself growing up of like, well, I may be, you know, unable to walk straight and I can't ride a bike and I'm not good at sports or PE. But, you know, the one thing that I do have is that I'm smart. So that's going to be like my trademark from now on. Like, people might call me a loser, but at least I'm smart.
How did other kids react to you and you to them?
You know, I didn't really relate very well with my peers growing up. In fact, in my book, it mentions a lot of the therapy that I went through as a young kid was play therapy. And I just didn't relate to the other kids at all. I had a much easier time when it was one-on-one, me with the therapist. And it kind of continued when I went into school. I just felt inherently different from them. And I couldn't really put my finger on why at that time. I felt just isolated. I didn't feel like anybody knew what I was going through. And I had these bouts of anger that would just make me kind of weird to other kids. And I think other kids were just kind of perplexed by me of, what's going on? And why does she lash out sometimes for no apparent reason and act like she's in pain all the time and sometimes just act superior and kind of, because I think sometimes I was just like, well, if I'm going to be a loser, I'm going to be a smart loser. Hmm. And so, it was a difficult time growing up.
You attended the Children's Center. Tell me about the Children's Center.
Yeah, it actually still exists here in Salt Lake City. It has two branches. It's a sort of treatment center for kids who have various emotional problems or mental health issues. They treat mental health issues a little differently than they did when I was a patient in the early 1980s. Now there's a lot of there's a lot more that we know about mental health in children, and at the time we didn't know as much. And it was an excellent facility of the combining play therapy and group therapy for kids, along with one-on-one therapy groups with the kids and then with their parents as well.
So with advances, I guess you think you would have been treated in the medical sense differently now?
Yeah, I do. And something I like to talk with people about, because I think that there was definitely a sense, I think at the time, that we didn't really understand depression, and we particularly didn't understand depression in children and didn't think, oh, you know, children get depression just like adults, because there was more this view of like, well, no, you're a child. You don't have mental illness yet. And it's something that we're only now figuring out more about, and even figuring out more about how to give children medication and figure out their mental health needs. It's interesting for me, I'm not sure if it was that my mental health was what gave, I mean, I think at the time people said, oh, it's her poor mental health that is giving her the headaches. You know, it's her high anxiety and depression that's giving her the headaches. Now, someone has a brain injury survivor, I don't know if that's the case so much as that it was the headaches that were giving me the mental health issues or the symptoms of a mental health issue. But I still think it's an issue that we need to address of making sure that our kids feel safe and are taken care of in the best way that we know how to.
Let's take a break. When we come back, more with Emily Wing Smith. She's a Salt Lake City author, and she's author of two previous novels, one of which I think won the Utah Book Award.
It did, yeah.
First one, yeah.
The
so
Way He Lives.
Congratulations. And the new memoir is All Better Now. Emily Wing Smith says that she is known in some circles as the "Thank God I Got Hit by a Car" girl. That's because after that accident, it was during that accident, in the aftermath of the accident, that the brain tumor that was undiscovered until she was 12 years old was discovered and removed. I want to talk, when we come back, more about the brain. It's mysterious. It's yeah. Interconnected. It's fragile. And you continue to, I think, to have problems, even though the tumor was removed. And there's a lot of emotional issues surrounding that as well. Ultimately, this is a motivational, inspiring memoir. Emily Wing Smith went on to get a master's in creative writing. She's a successful author. By the way, Emily Wing Smith, I'll have you read the prologue when we come back, so maybe get to that.
Oh,
passage.
Great. Okay.
Well, more with Emily Wing Smith following this break.
Today's Access Utah episode was first broadcast in March of 2016.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. All her life, Emily felt different from other kids. Between therapist visits, sudden uncontrollable bursts of anger, and unexplained episodes of dizziness, things never felt right. For years, her only escape was through the stories she crafted. It wasn't until a near-fatal accident when she was 12 years old that Emily and her family discovered the truth, a grapefruit-sized brain tumor at the base of her skull. And her new memoir is called All Better Now. We're talking with Utah writer Emily Wing Smith, who in her memoir chronicles her struggles with both mental and physical disabilities, the devastating accident that may have saved her life, and her way through it all, which was writing. And before we have you read the passage, the prologue from the book All Better Now, Emily Wing Smith, you were a very interesting kid. I think people will be drawn to you. The photograph of you, I'm not sure what age you are on the cover of the book, kind of tells the story. Very serious.
Yeah, this is my first grade school picture, so probably about six, maybe almost seven.
Not smiling at all, sort of glaring at the camera, but very, very serious, very determined as well, it looks like. You played a game, apparently, lying in your bed called Nobody Loves Me. Tell me about that.
Oh, yeah, that was, I used to have terrible insomnia when I was a kid, and I just wouldn't be able to go to sleep for hours, and one of the things that I would do is get undressed, because I found that when I was really cold, it made me tired. And I would hide out under my bed and try to kind of come up with scenarios of what terrible things could happen to me and why I would be just stranded and alone in a dark, cold place. And it was somehow comforting to me, I think, to then be able to get warm and then fall asleep, to feel like, oh, well, you know, if I have something really, really bad happen and I get really, really cold, then being warm and having nothing bad happen will be such a relief that it'll make it easier to go to sleep, because, you know, I'll just be so relieved that I'm finally warm and safe. And that was how I got to sleep a lot of times.
Interesting. So you're creating a narrative there. That's you're using your creative skills, your writing skills, in a sense.
Definitely. I always I feel like I was always a writer even before I could write, because it did take me kind of a while to get the hang of physically writing, because my dexterity is pretty limited. Now we know from the brain tumor. But I even before then, I feel like I was always crafting stories and always trying to give myself a happy ending or my characters.
Mm-hmm. That goes to the title, I guess, All Better Now. I guess you're imagining a future in which you're all better.
Exactly. So, So that's been something that has always been a part of my life since I was very, very young, constructing a story and a world in which I could, in which things made sense, kind of, and I could make sense of things.
Mm-hmm. Now, you made up a boyfriend.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Well, in particular, I should say I made up a friend who was a boyfriend for a friend who I felt like I was losing.
Oh, okay.
It was sort of to increase my social standing in a way. I knew that this girl who had been my best friend for years was kind of growing away from me and growing up, and I was kind of strange, and I think that I felt like I was losing her, and the only way that I felt like I could get her back was if I had created this guy for her that was interested in her, and that he was my friend. So the way that she would communicate with him was through me.
Mm-hmm.
The problem being, of course, that, you know, I'm not him. So that's why their correspondence was through letters.
Pretty creative. You, in fact, in the book, you include a couple of the letters.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I don't know that they were exactly as written because mm-hmm. I no longer have the letters in my possession because I mailed them to the friend. But I can remember a lot of what I wrote. And I would really work on them and work on crafting this different personality that wasn't me. It was completely opposite of me because, you know, it was this talented, popular, good-looking guy, and I was a loser. I mean, a smart loser, but I was a loser. But he wasn't, and he would be the kind of friend that she would want to have and that she would deserve. And, mm-hmm. and so, yeah, so I would work on that. That's how I could include them with pretty good recall.
His name was Rembrandt. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. I just, I didn't really have a name when she was like, so what's his name? And I was like, oh, Rembrandt. It was an artist we'd been studying in school. It just came to me. I don't know why she didn't guess right there and then, like, this is a complete fabrication. No one's name is Rembrandt, but it worked.
Now you described yourself as strange. I guess maybe even at the time you felt like, yeah, I'm different from the other people. But that becomes a positive, more of a positive as you grow older, right? Those unique qualities.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's been something that I've learned to embrace about myself. It's something that is easier, I think, to embrace as you get older. It becomes less important what other people think, and you get to know a wider variety of people who don't think you're strange and who think that your quirks are interesting, and that the things that you might have thought were negatives are really either positives or just something that makes you you.
Mm-hmm.
I think for a long time I thought, like, well, I'm Emily, and like Emily is just inherently broken, and so I will never be able to get all better because just I am broken. And then it was through my journey of the car accident and the brain tumor of realizing, well, no, there were parts of my body that were broken and they will never get all better. But the idea of, but what part of me is getting all better is realizing that Emily, the being Emily, was never broken. And it was just her body.
How do you think you get kids to get that message and internalize it? Kids are very self-obsessed. They're very obsessed with peer pressure and fitting in. And if they don't, that can be devastating sometimes.
Yeah, I think so. And I think even still, because I am really encouraged. I see a lot in my neighborhood there being and in local schools that I visit being more inclusive of quirks. It definitely seems, and I was talking with some friends of my age about this, it definitely seems like being unique, it's a little more accepted in a way of being able to be yourself and not have that make you a target. And I think before there was a message of like, be yourself. But being yourself didn't make you a target if yourself wasn't similar to everybody else. So I think we've come a long way. I think there's I feel like we're doing a good job as a society of raising awareness of different things that are differences that before might have just been viewed as, she's weird because she's brain damaged. Instead of saying, oh, no, she has a brain injury, but that's not a big deal, or someone isn't neurotypical. They might be on the spectrum, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they are, you know, going to be completely isolated and completely different. There's a lot more work mainstreaming. But I still think, you know, when you're a kid, you always want to fit in and to have friends and to be accepted. And I don't know really what the message is to say other than just stay strong and keep going, and that you will find people who get you. And sometimes it's hard when you're in the middle of it and thinking, I'm never going to find people who get me. But you will. You just have to hold out long enough.
We're talking, if you just joined us, with Emily Wing Smith. She's a Utah writer, and her memoir is out. All Better Now is what it's called. Let me have you read the prologue now, page 3 and then over page 4.
Okay, great. Yeah, so, yeah, just right before the story begins. Prologue. I ask myself, how am I living still? And how I ask it depends on the day. Most mornings I wake up woo head. A brief etymology. Woozy head became woo's head became woo head. Woo head is this headache hybrid that isn't made up of different kinds of pain exactly. It's dizziness and it's lightheadedness, and it's a tremble that starts between my temples and comes out the right side of my body. Bad hand gets the shakes. Usually I can stand up. I put on my glasses. I stagger to the bathroom mirror and stare into my eyes. Sometimes my pupils are big still and the same size, and I know that woo head will dissipate, so I get ready for the day. But sometimes my pupils are already constricted, even though there's no light, and my head is spinning so fast, and I fall to the floor. And those are the mornings I ask myself, how am I living still? I take my emergency meds that only halfway help and go back to bed, and this will be a long day, one with no writing and no reading, and how am I living still? Every once in a great while, though, I wake up and there's no woo head, and I get out of bed and make sure it's not a trick. I wash my hair and I tilt my head back, and still, no woo head. I think, after everything that's happened, here I am, washing my hair. There's no woo head, there's no pain, and bad hand even helps out, rubbing shampoo onto my scalp. My fingers gloss over the incision on the back of my head and the scars on the top of my head, and nope, no pain, none at all. And I think, how am I living still? How am I living my dream, being a writer, publishing books, and hanging out with writer friends? How am I living with a man who adores me, who never gets fed up with woo head or bad hand, or demands a normal wife whose pupils are always the same size? How am I living still? I ask God, but it's not really a question, because I know him well enough to know he won't answer me. Not yet. How am I living still, I say, and I know he knows that what I mean is thank you.
That's the prologue to the book All Better Now, a memoir by Emily Wing Smith. So gratitude to God, but I imagine, especially when you woke up from the car accident, they removed the brain tumor, had an explanation that was the reason for a lot of these problems. Did you think, okay, brain tumor removed, I won't have these problems anymore?
You know, I did to a large extent. Part of me thought, I don't know. I hope that this works, sort of, because I was like, well, a lot of things were supposed to work, you know. Getting glasses was supposed to help get rid of my headaches, you know. Going to therapy was supposed to help get rid of my, like, nothing has worked so far, but this getting rid of the tumor, certainly that's going to work. And, but then there was that tiny part of me that was like, oh, what if it doesn't? But I think that to most other people too, we thought, yeah, of course, like the tumor was causing the headaches. Thus, without the tumor, there will be no headaches. And that wasn't really how it worked. A lot of it, because now I had another head injury too. I had gotten a frontal head injury from the car accident. So now I was dealing with the repercussions of the frontal head injury and the repercussions of having the brain tumor removed, which weren't small. I still had a large incision that was deep and slow to heal. And I also had the repercussions of missing a large portion of my brain that had been overtaken, more or less, by the tumor itself. So getting better was a real process, more than just Okay, well, good. That's taken care of now. You're good to go.
This gets us into, the brain. The brain's still mysterious to us. So we've made a lot of advances. Interconnected. And I guess you're living proof of the power of the brain to heal. But still, when it has trauma, a lot of those interconnections mean that you have problems in various areas.
Yeah, exactly. This month is Brain Injury Awareness Month, as I think I stated earlier. And when I speak about brain injuries, I say they're the invisible disability, because the brain affects every part of our body, but you can't see it because the brain is hidden away inside the head, and you never know what part of the body it's damaging. Damaging the brain is going to affect. You never know what it's going to what it's going to be like for you, because each brain injury is different in how it affects people. Even if it's a similar kind of a brain injury, it will still affect different people differently. We just don't know enough about the brain, and certainly didn't then, and know more now, but are still nowhere near knowing how it works and everything about it.
Let's take another break. When we come back, more with Emily Wing Smith. The memoir is All Better Now. By the way, I'll have you read page 211 when we come back. This is a chapter called
Great.
How It Doesn't Happen, and it's accompanying a little older Emily with a smile. That's a good progress there from the picture on the cover. Emily Wing Smith is with us. She's a Salt Lake City author, has written two previous books, young adult novels. The first one, The Way He Lived, which has now been reissued, won the Utah Book Award. The other one is called Back When You Were Easier to Love. And the memoir is All Better Now. More following the break.
Today's Access Utah episode was first broadcast in March of 2016.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. We are talking with Emily Wing Smith. She's a Salt Lake City author who's out with a very interesting new memoir, All Better Now. And as we've mentioned, she's sometimes known as the "Thank God She Got Hit by a Car" girl. That's because at age 12, some of the problems she'd been experiencing up to that point were explained after she was hit by a car. A CAT scan revealed a tumor at the base of her skull. That was removed, but she still had to go on to deal with brain injury, post-brain injury problems. And we are talking about the memoir on the program today. Emily Wing Smith with us for another 10 minutes. So let me have you read this, page 211, and then the first two paragraphs of the next page.
Great. How It Doesn't Happen. Here is how it doesn't happen. My hair doesn't quickly grow back into a shiny, cute, regular teen girl mane. My headaches don't gradually get better until they disappear entirely. When I go to physical therapy, I don't get stronger and stronger and watch my right hand become functional, because the only thing holding it back was the brain tumor, and now that it's gone, I'm healed and hunky-dory. I don't start playing sports. My tumor-free body doesn't prove that deep within me has always lived a tennis star waiting to be set free. With time, I don't go back to reading as fast as I used to before the accident. Homework doesn't get easier. I don't find friends who really get me, who support me through thick and thin. I do not get less anxious. I do not get less sad. I do not feel like the "Thank God She Got Hit by a Car" girl. What happens is this. By eighth grade, I can read more and more without getting headaches, but it takes me longer to finish books. I get a free period for homework. I become editor of my junior high newspaper. I keep writing. My headaches are worse than they've ever been, and doctors can't tell why exactly, just that head injuries are different for everyone. The woozy-headed feeling doesn't go away, and I start calling it Wooze Head, and it becomes my constant companion. I go to physical therapy, and before long, my arms and legs work. And to look at me, you'd never know I was hit by a car. The angular scar on my forehead fades a little bit every day, and I rub it with vitamin E oil like I'm supposed to. And by the time ninth grade rolls around, you can't see it unless you look close. I still don't use bad hand. I have a doctor's note getting me out of PE. I take a full college prep load, so I don't have time for a free period, but I manage good grades without it. Most medicines don't work. I shorten Woo's head to Woo head, and the nickname fits, so it sticks. I am lonely and overwhelmed most of the time. I keep writing. In 10th grade, I start Mid Valley High School. I sleep a lot. I get a bicycle, and I practice until I can ride it well enough not to get made fun of. I wear a helmet. The neuropsychologist recommends I get a part-time job to provide me with increased independence and self-esteem. So I bus tables at the ice cream parlor next to Payless Shoe Source, and every day I go to work and cross the street where I got hit by a car. I keep writing. One of my English assignments gets published in the school paper, and I'm chosen to be on the newspaper staff, even though I'm only a sophomore. My parents announce we are moving to New Galilee. When people find out my story, they're always amazed. They call me the thank God she got hit by a car girl.
Yeah, it's amazing. And through it all, it's the writing, right? It's your creative skills that really help you. I want to talk a little bit more about that. We do have an email from a listener who says, living with a brain injury isn't easy. We aren't perfect. Nobody is. People make fun of us, think we're weird, but when it comes to everyday life, we do the best we can. We deal with everyday life differently. We enjoy the life we're given. We know how to do everyday things. We just do life differently. Thanks for that email. And that, I think, well said.
That's excellent. That's exactly how I would put it. So, yeah.
By the way, you can join the program. We have another 5 minutes left with Emily Wing Smith. UPRAccess@gmail.com. UPRAccess@gmail.com. I was thinking, I was reading the synopsis a little bit about your first book. By the way, they both seem like good reads. So the first book, The Way He Lived, it's a story about a young man who has died. And then there's several other young people. And through, I guess, their eyes, his life is sort of pieced together. Is that an accurate description?
Yes, exactly. That's what I tell people, that you find out how he lived and who he was and how he died, and essentially about him through the voices of six different people who knew him.
Then I, as we're talking here today, I made a connection with your memoir. You're, in a sense, you're piecing together your own life. There's a lot of different Emilys there.
It's so true, and I think there are so many sides to everyone, and I feel like I wrote them in a similar style too. When I started writing The Way He Lived, it was piecing together different characters and different voices who knew different sides of Joel, my main character who died. And I think through this, I was piecing together pieces of Emily through various memories, and the various memories took place at different times in my life when I was different Emilys. So, it was a very similar, it's a similar style. And even the writing process was similar, even though it's fiction versus nonfiction.
By the way, before we close, I want to bring this in because I think it may be helpful for people. I think this is why you included it. On top of everything else, this kid Emily's going through, you were sexually assaulted. It just seems like too much. Must have been a difficult decision to decide to include that in the book.
Yeah, it was. I didn't want to make it seem, but first of all, I was very wary of making it seem overly sentimental, in the sense of, oh, life is so hard, please pity me. Like I really, really wanted to avoid that. Because that wasn't what I wanted at all. It was actually when a friend came to me, and she was telling me, she did not know about my experience, but she said, you know, my daughter has come to me and just in tears, and the way that we found out about this horrible abuse that's been ongoing from a family member in her life for many years was that she was having trouble in school. She couldn't relate to any of her peers. She wasn't making friends, and finally one night she just burst out into tears and said, you know, I just don't understand. School is so hard. I don't get along with any of the people there, and like after what has happened to me, how would anybody understand who I am and what I'm going through? And it chilled me because that was exactly my response and my reaction to trying to deal with this. And I wouldn't really say that it has a story arc and that, you know, justice was served and everything is fine and I've worked through all my issues through therapy. It was more gradual than that. But I knew that I needed to include that segment for people like my friend's daughter who were reacting in the exact same way of like, why am I different? Why am I weird? I knew I was the weird one that was chosen to be victimized because I was the one who had a target on my back because I'm the weird one. And seeing it manifest through her in such a similar way to me, I thought, okay, this is a story that needs to be told, not because I want sympathy for myself, but because I want all the other girls to know that I have sympathy for them, and not just sympathy, but I know them and I feel what they're feeling, and we can fix this as well as we know how if we all share our stories and you can feel that you're not alone.
Yeah, it's an important message, isn't it, it's not because of whatever you are or did. It's totally on the perpetrator, and you're not at fault here in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, and I think it's a message we can't state enough because it's still, you know, even when we say it, it doesn't always ring true to victims.
Mm-hmm. So, I wonder, just final question, and I want to make sure people know that young Emily grew up to be successful and happy, right? What's the message you want people to take away, especially young people from the book?
I do want to take that away, and I tell people that I would hope that the message that they would be left with is that even when you think you can't get all better, you can get all better, but it's on your own terms. And similar to the email that you had just received of like, yeah, we go through daily life the best way we know how. And that's true of all of us, whether we have a brain injury or not. And that getting all better for you might not look like it looks for other people, but that doesn't mean that it isn't great and that you won't eventually be able to find a good way of a good life. And I feel very happy. I feel lucky for the life that I have now. And I have a good family. I have a good husband. I'm living what I've always wanted to do, be a writer. And I deal with headaches and I deal with woo head and lack of coordination and various other things, but I have a good life. And I want other people and yeah, teens especially, and those growing up to know, just hold on because you can get better in your own way, and that's okay. That's just as acceptable as the standard popular girl's version of all better. Yours is just as valid.
That's a good place to leave it. We're out of time. The memoir is called All Better Now. The author is Emily Wing Smith, and her website is emilywingsmith.com. Emily, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Our thanks to Emily Wing Smith. That's a repeat of our broadcast from March of 2016.
It's one sky, many cultures. Skywatcher Leo T here. On Earth, give yourself a treat if you can and get up to the mountains or by a stream or lake or ocean and feel the fresh breeze of higher elevation. Smell the pines. Watch the wildlife of all sorts come out as you sit still. Watch the day evolve and then the stars come out at night and look up to the north for Cassiopeia. The big W in the sky and veer off at about a 30-degree angle to the lower right of the right elbow, the upper elbow, and with your binoculars find our neighboring galaxy, Andromeda, looking kind of like a puff of smoke or a smudgy cloud. It's what a galaxy looks like from 2.5 million light years away. And in the dawn in the east-northeast, Venus and Jupiter draw closer together, a close separation now. They're already having some fun up there. And around 10 or 11 in the night in the south is Saturn. It will be visible to the naked eye as a moderately bright star with an orange color. Binoculars will show its elongated shape while a small telescope will show its rings. And Saturn's rings are almost edge-on this year, but they're starting to open up again. And Saturn is now offering a treat as well. Beginning August 2nd and 3rd, its moon, Titan, casts its shadow on Saturn. Saturn's largest moon crosses Saturn's face from Earth's viewpoint and casts its very tiny black shadow on Saturn's face. August 3rd, Titan's shadow will cross Saturn from 12:25 a.m. to 5:04 a.m. And if anybody's interested, I'll take out my little burgundy scope. We'll go out there and have a look somewhere in the dark. So let me know on the Facebook page, Skywatcher Facebook page, for all sorts of photos and all sorts of connections. And of course, we're in meteor shower season with three of them streaking after midnight. The Southern Delta Aquarids, the Alpha Capricornids, and the largest, of course, the Perseids. Best time to look north and east and up, and really they can come from many areas, after midnight till dawn. So get a lawn chair and a blanket and perhaps your favorite beverage and watch the skies behind a pine, or better yet, a mountain campground with three showers expected to produce over a dozen visible meteors per hour under dark skies. The triple header means the total number of meteors do add up. So Thaddeus Le Corsevier, Planetarium Program Director at the Bell Museum in St. Paul, Minnesota. And, you know, if we're lucky, we may see up to 100 an hour. We'll see. You got to be pretty lucky and be in the dark. Also paying attention are scientists from several universities studying results from James Webb discovery of a space rock called 2024 YR4, which they're saying has a slim chance of hitting the moon in 2032, about a 4.32 chance. That would create a visible crater and rain incredible meteor showers toward Earth for a while. Wow. Well, we'll see if we're still around. That's a pretty slim chance it's going to hit the moon, but you know, it's space. And excited to go into space, astronauts Zena Cardman and Mike Finke, along with Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency, or JAXA, astronaut Kimyaya Yui and Roscosmos cosmonaut Oleg Platonov, who flew to Kennedy Space Center launch facility on the 26th of July. The multinational crew will launch to the bright light in the sky, where unique scientific research happens in low Earth orbit, with teamwork and scientists from multiple countries. That's what's going on up there, and hopefully, well, we're going to let it slip away, apparently, into commercial ventures instead. But we can pray. As this episode is produced on the 30th, hopefully all went well on the morning launch on the 31st, on Thursday, when this program airs first on UPR. Go Astros, go! And on space travels, we use navigation by stars. Using the stars for navigation isn't a new idea. People have done it on Earth throughout the history, getting across the continent, sailing the seas. The Polynesians were amazing. The early NASA missions up to now rely on star navigation. Those NASA and Russian spacecraft use sextants to sight their navigation stars, just as the ships in the 1400s. And more recently, traveling in the solar system, the Voyager spacecraft, the Hubble spacecraft, the Hubble Space Telescope, and New Horizons have star trackers to keep them in proper attitude and on course. What happens when your spacecraft leaves the solar system? In the case of New Horizons, way, way outside of our solar systems, it's amazing. The New Horizons probe is Earth's fastest moving spacecraft other than the Parker Solar Probe, and it's headed out into interstellar space. Since its exploration of Pluto 10 years ago and subsequent flyby of snowman rock Ultima Thule in 2019, it's been traversing and studying the Kuiper Belt while looking for other flyby objects. And as it is, one sky, many cultures, and July 29th was the Day of the Tiger, a day to recognize one of our favorite big cats and call attention to the plight of these fine beings. And Susan Seddon Boulay's Animal Spirit Cards from Pomegranate Communications, the tiger, symbolism, primal power, creation, sexuality, and perception. While all the feline images denote power, tigers are particularly powerful. In China, they are considered the king of all beasts. In Hindu mythology, the tiger is associated with the goddess Kali, who represents creation, sexuality, and death, which gives them greater depth of vision and the ability to judge distances accurately. The eye of the tiger symbolizes sound judgment and keen perception, which we could sure use some of now. So keep looking up, look around, and get just a little bit lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T,